Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Well, hello again, my incredible audience, my wonderful, wonderful audience. It is always just such a wonderful opportunity to get to talk to you. And you're looking at the wonderful face of David Hanscom. David is a surgeon. He has been a surgeon, a neurologist. And we're talking about things that are really interesting and really dovetail with my work, with all the concerns that you have, and everything from COVID-19, which we'll probably do a separate show about, to how do you handle physical pain, how do you handle mental pain. Things are changing out there. I do want to again thank the Progressive Radio Network and for allowing me to do my radio show and film it and make it into my own TV show every Wednesday at 4 p.m. We go on to the Progressive Network, and then onto my really large YouTube channel. And I have a brand new report out. It's a kind of a follow-up report on the big booklet, book, 125 pages I did for the Ohio lawsuit, which is already having an impact with an injunction that is trying to enjoin the governor of Ohio to stop abusing his people under the emergency edict. And other people are getting interested in this. They're reading my report. And now I've come out with a report about Fauci, Anthony Fauci, honing in on one subject only, which is how he so arduously went ahead and pushed the United States to cooperate with China and to fund China to create viruses that can kill people out of normal coronaviruses, pulling them out of the poor bats, making them lethal. And then how he covered up what had happened at Wuhan, and then how he supported the release of people, passengers, thousands of air flights from China, spreading the virus around the world while he shut down his own traffic internally. It's a whole story where the man who's now gaining in fortune for his institute and great power, how that man, Fauci, is taking advantage of the very, very virus he helped create. He helped create these virulent coronaviruses with the Chinese. There's going to be lots of surprises in it. This isn't the first time China's leaked a coronavirus. It's not the second time China has released a coronavirus. Everything documented. So this is going to be a really important thing for you to read. And it just came out a couple of days ago. And it's all about the good Dr. Fauci, my second report on this whole big issue. So I want to go now to David Hanscom. We have had just a wonderful conversation beforehand. There's just a lot of doctors now are beginning to see more and more, including me. I keep learning about this. Those of you who've been following me thought probably I was a madman leaving behind my source of fame and fortune, or fame anyway, or a little bit, in the psychiatric field, and then going into this COVID-19, because I think it's about the future of America, and we just can't have a man like Fauci, you know, staying in powers and so on. We really have to get serious about it. And I'm really branching out. And one of the ways I branched out is I made a new friend, Beth Grossman. Beth is David Hanscom's PR, his publicist. And she has sent me a couple of people for my show. And then she and I got to be friends. She's just a lovely human being, and I want to thank her. And she's helping me branch out. not just from psychiatry into this COVID-19, but into a lot of other areas. This is going to be a show whose common underlying theme is truth in medicine, truth in the world, truth in anything, but in this great big broad field of healing and medicine, not just where we've been before. And I hope this will be good for all of you and bring in many more people. Tell your friends there's been a change here. David has a new book out. It's Do You Really Need Spine Surgery? Back it up a little bit. And having introduced him, I just want to let him go on, talk to you about back pain, and talk to you about why he, like me, is so disillusioned with medicine in the standard form. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour.
Well, Peter, thank you very much. I'm excited that you got to meet Beth. She is a wonderful person and very genuine, very warm, very sincere, very energy, a lot of energy too.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, so it's great. So anyway, but I'm excited to be on your show. It was fun talking to you for the first half hour. And as you know, we're going to be really careful to keep things reined in because we could talk for a long time. But you and I'm a surgeon, orthopedic spine surgeon. I practiced in Seattle from 1985, 86 until December 2018. And what happened for 15 years, I developed chronic pain. And it started out as a panic attack. And I went from being a complex spine surgeon. I did the most difficult cases that exist. And I did that for many years. And I was driving across a bridge in Seattle, the 520 bridge, and I had a panic attack. And I'm going, what is this? So I went being this fearless surgeon who actually did not know what anxiety was to a panic attack. And for the next 13 years, I cannot put this back into the back. So I developed 17 different physical symptoms of migraine headaches, ringing in my ear, skin rashes that popped up around my body, back pain, neck pain. And so I had 17 different physical symptoms and I could not figure out what was going on. And of course, medicine has a name for this called medically unexplained symptoms. So what I hope to convey to the audience today is that these symptoms are completely explainable about your body's response to the environment. Basically, what's your body's chemistry like in a realm of safety versus threat? So it turns out that for me personally, that I was a very self-critical, high-performance surgeon, and what drove me to the top was this self-critical voice. Never good enough, never good enough, and I became excellent at what I did, but at the same time, my feet were burning, my ears were ringing, I had migraine headaches, I had back pain, neck pain, and I just thought this was life. I just kept plowing along, just bring it on was my attitude. And then I developed this panic attack in 1990 where I was driving across a bridge and I started to sweat, my heart started to race, and I thought I was going to die. So I thought I was having a heart attack, but I was only 37 years old.
Oh my.
So turns out that things got way worse, and by 1997, I developed a full-blown obsessive-compulsive disorder, which, as you well know, being a psychiatrist, is a horrible ordeal. So I think it's the ultimate anxiety disorder. So here I am again going from this incredibly competent, fearless surgeon to crippling anxiety, and I couldn't control it. And surgeons, as you know, have control issues, and I couldn't control this. Anyway, jumping ahead to 2003, I read this book, Feeling Good by David Burns, and he said to start doing these writing exercises. So I started to write, and within 2 weeks, things started to shift. And by 6 weeks, things were much better. And 6 months later, I was fine. Now, there's obviously a learning curve in there, so I still did not know what happened. I did not know how I came out of this thing. So I started on this quest to find the answer. And about a year ago, the pieces really fit together. So first of all, I thought it was the book. Let me see if I can find this book here. I don't have it. The book's called Opening Up by Writing It Down. It's by Dr. James Pennebaker out of Austin, Texas. And what he has documented, there's over 1,000 research papers that document the simple act of writing down your thoughts and tearing them up makes a huge difference. So it decreases viral load, it improves kidney function, liver function, improves wound healing. And so there's over 1,000 research papers that documents that some form of expressive writing somehow drops down your body's inflammatory markers.
Do you think that's why I'm 84 years old and so healthy? Because I've been my whole life, and half of what I write I throw away. So that's right. That's cleansing that process.
Yeah, no, it could be. So it's fascinating. So I thought it was the book, but it turns out that the expressive writing is a very powerful tool. So the problem with chronic pain is basically threat versus safety. So when you're under threat, your heart races, you breathe faster, you sweat, your muscles are tight, your blood vessels constrict. All sorts of things happen when you're under threat. But what I didn't understand is a couple things. One of them is we understand viruses and bacteria are threats. So are bullies, bad bosses, unpleasant spouses, etc., are threats. But we also found out that thoughts, unpleasant thoughts and emotions are processed in the same area of the brain as a physical threat. So you have the same reaction in the brain and the same physiological response. Turns out that repressed thoughts and emotions are also a threat that are even worse than ones that you experience. So whether you experience these unpleasant thoughts or suppress them, either way, your body is fired up and under threat. What happened to me in retrospect is that I was a master at suppressing stress. I mean, I keep telling my wife that normal people don't become spine surgeons, and I still think I'm right on that one. But I was incredible at taking threat and just stuffing it. So I started developing these physical symptoms because what happens under threat, again, you have adrenaline, cortisol, histamines, noradrenaline, et cetera, but you also have inflammatory cytokines, which creates a massive inflammatory process throughout your entire body. So what happens, your body, so this thing called, so anxiety is this word we use to describe this chemical reaction. So my cat has the same reaction, but she doesn't have language. Humans have language, and we call it anxiety. So anxiety is a result of a threat, not the cause. So it's a physiological response to the environment. So the essence of the problem is a sustained exposure to threat, which is obviously physical threats for all of us, but it turns out that mental threats are a bigger problem than physical threats because you can't escape your thoughts. So it turns out that this expressive writing exercises isn't anything more than simply separating from your thoughts. You can't control them, you can't suppress them and have any difference, but you simply separate from them. So that's not the solution, that's just the starting point of a process.
Can I stop there? I don't want to break your flow. I just think that's really important, and right. I think it's worth mulling on. I'm not sure that I've ever heard this discussed in such detail, that literally all the stuff that we talk about, and we've all now heard about these cytokine storms, which maybe you could say a few more words about, which is so dangerous with COVID-19, and that that the whole business of inflammatory reactions and storms, that it's stimulated as powerfully by the feeling of being under assault by your own thoughts,
right,
or by other people, or any kind of of assault. It's like, us poor folks now, we're being not only assaulted by potentially cytokine storms from the SARS-CoV-2. I mean, we're going to get it from thinking about the epidemic and experiencing the social stresses of it,
right.
This common final pathway. How new is that as a basic idea? I just think that's a showstopper for me.
Well, it's a showstopper for me too, because it's been what really, I'll use the word disturbing to me, is that there's over 1,000 research papers that document that some form of expressive writing works. And so the leading psychiatrists and psychologists in the world, Dr. Pennebaker, Dr. Smythe, and Dr. Daniel Wegner out of Boston, familiar with great schools of psychiatry, et cetera, found out that the only these obsessive thought patterns were simply writing them down. And so that's in 1987, that paper was published. Dr. Pennebaker started publishing in 1982. The thing that's really disturbing to me, and I'm learning this from Dr. Stephen Porges, a psychologist out of Florida, who's really delineated the autonomic nervous system very carefully, is that this has been in the literature for over 25 years. So the other problem with threat is that your immune system fires up. And when your immune system fires up, your body throws off these little proteins, or very small proteins, called cytokines. So there's anti-inflammatory cytokines, and then there's inflammatory cytokines. And so they're in the brain, the glial cells. We know in chronic pain, your brain gets hypersensitized. That's from inflammation of the glial cells in the brain. So these glial cells are, these cytokines are everywhere. And what they are, they're little proteins that communicate between cells. The first cytokines, as you know, were interleukins. And so as a white cell went to an infection, it sent off a signal to bring other white cells to the area to help fight the infection. So the cytokines are the little messengers that are pretty much everywhere in the body on every cell. And so what happens that you have, let's talk about the COVID for a second, you have a viral infection, and every minute your body's picking off bacteria, viruses, foreign bodies, cancer cells in your blood every day, all the time. If you don't have an immune system, you don't survive. So a healthy immune system is important to have inflammation, important to have it functioning. They're the sentinels that guard your body against invaders. And so what happens is that when the immune system works, it's great. The immune system's first fired up to fight off the coronavirus. So there's the immune system that picks off the virus, kills it, gets rid of it. But then all of a sudden the virus gains a foothold, and then you have an inflammatory response to try to really crank up the response. So the problem is, it's not that cytokines are a problem and that the inflammation is a problem. In fact, it's necessary. But, you know, the elephant in the room is that almost every person that's died of COVID has pre-existing risk factors. So people go, yeah, we know we should eat better, we should be healthier, et cetera. But here's the problem. And this is what's disturbing to me as a physician, is that when I talk to my colleagues, we meet once a week on a round table, either we weren't taught about cytokines or we forgot about them. We just didn't pay much attention to them. Okay. We never really thought about the immune system response to a threat. So you have this sustained inflammation. And so it turns out that adult onset diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are all associated with very high inflammatory markers. It also turns out that anxiety, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and OCD are also inflammatory disorders. What we're finding, and this has been in the literature for over 20 years. So it's disturbing to me as a physician, nobody ever taught this to me. It's been in the literature for 20 years, maybe longer. I remember 30 years ago, a rheumatology friend of mine was talking about how inflammation was causing this chronic disease. I'm going, what? I mean, come on, there's no sense here. So as an orthopedic surgeon, I'm focused on structure. I'm not focused on physiology so much. I'm certainly not focused on the immune system. Turned out the immune system is probably the biggest factor in keeping us alive. And not only the biggest, they're all important. But with the COVID crisis, if you start out with elevated markers to begin with, then just the normal inflammatory response can kill you and does kill you. Mm-hmm. So I wrote up a booklet that I sent to you this morning. We'll talk about this later, called Plan A, which is essentially my project. Is that there's a lot of ways of lowering your inflammatory markers and maximizing your odds. And I think I told you I had COVID in March. I was sick for 5 days with muscle aches, low-grade fevers, and a lot of fatigue, and I'm fine. I have the antibodies, and I'm fine. But I practice what I preach.
Mm-hmm.
So I could be better. So, for instance, just simple things like an anti-inflammatory diet drops your cytokines, or losing weight drops your cytokines. Forgiveness drops your cytokines, right? There's ways of processing.
This is genuine anxiety. Holistic medicine, doctor.
Right, but this is medicine. I mean, I think that mainstream medicine is not. So I think holistic medicine is medicine. So what's happening right now, don't you think? I mean, we have lost our souls to the business of medicine.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the epidemic is just the business of medicine writ large, with Bill Gates making a fortune right now, Fauci's getting all his power and stuff, because instead of actually fixing the epidemic with much more moderate social interventions and using very similar anti-inflammatory, anti-cytokine treatments would be much, much better off than what we were getting from the big medical establishment. I want to pick up on one thing that would matter a lot to my audience, many people in it. You mentioned the, I think you said schizophrenia, is a inflammatory disease.
Right.
And I don't think so, but I think you're right, but I don't think that's the way to think about it. I think that what you're teaching today is that all major stresses, psychological, spiritual, real, whatever, will cause inflammation and even
right.
cytokine storms in response, excessive response to the inflammation.
Right.
I do not believe that there is a stitch of biological causation behind schizophrenia. That's been looked at for a million years. Slight exaggeration, hyperbole.
Right.
And there's just no evidence. The only reason it even exists in the minds of people that way is because we're medical doctors and everything has to be medical. Drug companies want to sell drugs and they get together with the doctors. So I would like to say that my own theoretical and I believe correct framework would be that much of what we call, if not everything we call a psychiatric illness, involves, well, they all do. They're all stresses. They're all stress
right.
reactions. They're all miseries
right.
in reaction to life of one kind or another, but it's to life. And then those stresses you're so beautifully explaining cause inflammatory markers. So
right.
the next time I hear some psychiatrist say we have inflammatory markers for schizophrenia, which I knew was not true, we just know that schizophrenia is so-called, that is a very unhappy, very stressed out human being.
Right.
Probably getting drugged, maybe getting shocked, probably been locked up and maybe abused as a child.
Right.
Is going to have a lot of inflammatory markers.
Right.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, and I have to totally defer to you on schizophrenia. I don't know anything about it. Just one paper I read. And so you're right. The question is it cause and effect or which what? Is it coincidental or cause and effect?
I think the psychological disorders you're saying cause these physical effects. And I think that that's so true. And it's true. Schizophrenia, every psychiatrist wants to believe schizophrenia is it's the gold-plated disease. It's really physical and genetic. It's not. There's no, that evidence sucks. But I can see why you get inflammatory markers with anything that's a human misery.
Yeah.
This is interesting.
Well, I mean, the essence of chronic pain is result of sustained exposure to threat.
And then
you have a body's total physiological reaction to it. And the reason why this is so critical to understand is that like Stephen Porges, again, he wrote the polyvagal theory, and he looks at the autonomic nervous system very carefully. He says, get rid of the word anxiety. It's just a heightened sympathetic response to a threat. So humans have language that we call anxiety, but the bottom line is your body has these reactions. You feel uncomfortable. The reaction is intended to be so uncomfortable that it causes you to take action. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. So the key issue is that the unconscious brain processes about 20 million bits of information per second. The conscious brain processes 40. It's 20 million versus 40.
That's so interesting.
So you can't do this with mind over matter. But like, for instance, I'm sitting here. I'm unconsciously shifting to my chair. I'm not trying to figure out how my jaw muscles are moving to talk to you. My pupils are dilating and constricting. I mean, there's so much. I mean, the vast majority of your body's functions are automatic.
Mm-hmm.
So we have consciousness, which gives us a soul and gives us language. But that's only about is 20 million versus 40. So there's mental threat that creates this physiological response. But the actual physiological response, once it happens, you can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's ways of dampening it down. There's a lot of anti-inflammatory ways to do this. So, for instance, breathing techniques, slow breathing directly stimulates the vagus nerve, which is anti-inflammatory. When you're doing mindfulness meditation, those are anti-inflammatory activities. Humming stimulates the back of your throat, which is the seventh cranial nerve, which stimulates the vagus nucleus. So humming is anti-inflammatory.
Like that om.
Yeah.
It's right in the back of the throat there.
Right. So what I find really fascinating, I have to tell you, like your eye muscles, You probably know EMDR much better than I do.
No, not really, but I have some idea about it. But go ahead.
So I'm going as a surgeon. I'm going, are you kidding me? I mean, what, you're talking about eye movements, and that's going to have some effect on somebody? It turns out that all the facial muscles are connected to the vagus nerve. It's actually an anti-inflammatory activity. So what's interesting, and again, as a surgeon, I still have a hard time even thinking about this, but it's interesting connecting all these, quote, alternative practices with the vagus nerve, which is actually strongly anti-inflammatory. Certain tones of music, like lullaby-type music, stimulates the vagus nerve because it tightens the muscles of the middle ear. And so low tones are very threatening, and your tighter muscles allow you to hear the higher tones better, so it allows us to co-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
We also know one of the home runs for chronic pain is social interaction. And so it turns out that Sue Carter is Dr. Portis's wife. She is phenomenal, just an incredible human being. Is spent her life on oxytocin, which to me is just a pregnancy lactation drug. Turns out oxytocin is one of the older molecules in the body. It's everywhere. It's strongly anti-inflammatory. So it turns out that social connection has been a huge factor in solving chronic pain. Turns out that probably what the mechanism is with the social connection is oxytocin and anti-inflammatory. So it's just interesting understanding all this in terms of the body's physiology. So again, the problem is with chronic pain is that so to me, anxiety is the pain. Anxiety simply says danger. Pain says danger. To me, they're the same thing. But I want to tell a story that illustrates, I think, the problem in spine surgery. So I wrote an article called, Am I Operating on Your Pain or Your Anxiety? So about 10 years ago, I had four gentlemen come into my office, all between ages 40 and 60, very successful. One was a SWAT team member. One was a big real estate developer. Every one of them had structural surgical problems. Every one of them wanted surgery. But I noticed on their spine questionnaire, each one of them had high anxiety. So I looked at them and go, wait a second. So if I did surgery and got rid of your leg pain and you had to live with the anxiety you're experiencing right now the rest of your life, or I could drop down your anxiety and you had to live with the leg pain, which one would you choose? Every one of them wanted to get rid of the anxiety way more than the leg pain.
Wow.
And so what they did, they grabbed their leg and said, well, you know, if I get rid of my leg pain, won't my anxiety drop? I go, no, it's a different animal. So what happens paradoxically, as you remember, anxiety is a sensation generated by the stress response. The way you decrease anxiety is simply decrease the stress chemical. So as I worked with them over 3 to 6 months, their anxiety dropped down. They started to thrive again. Their pain went away. Because when your body's full of stress chemicals, you've doubled the nerve conduction. The animals show that your nerve conduction doubles under the presence of chronic stress. So as you drop down the stress reaction, stress chemicals, your nerve conduction slows down, pain goes away. Every one of those with surgical lesions, the pain disappeared. I had over 120 patients with severe spinal stenosis, very tight canals, leg pain, very classic surgical candidates. The data says do rehab first. You know, get their sleep controlled, adjust their medications, work on anxiety, frustration, have some psychological support, etc. So we would do that with every elective surgery for 12 weeks, every patient, every time. They would come in for their final preoperative visit. They canceled the surgery. Pain was gone. And these are spinal canals that were down to 5 millimeters, where the normal is about 15 millimeters. It was unbelievable. So I honestly put myself out of business as I just help people learn to teach themselves to calm down. Pain went away. Blew me away.
That's just wonderful. You know, one of the interests that I've had, especially in the last 5 or 6, 7, 8 years or so, increasingly has been in diet. And Pam Popper, whom I'm going to introduce you to, has been on the show regularly, and she runs an organization which fundamentally is about informed consent for medical procedures and medicines and alternatives. And she's a nutritionist. And her whole theory is that food is medicine, because if you eat a vegetable-based diet, you are eating anti-inflammatory foods. and that meats are inflammatory and dairy is terribly inflammatory. So folks, this just so fits into this broadening awareness I'm getting, and perhaps you're getting it along with me, and that the doc's getting, and we're all getting to, as we learn more and more about different fields. So everything we've been talking about on this show, especially with Pam Popper, but with some other folks, about a vegetable-based diet, a plant-based diet, low in fat, low in protein, a lot of good solid stuff you pick out of nature, whole foods, that this affects everything in a positive way. And again, the theme is, and it's no different at all from what you're saying, it's in part because they're anti-inflammatory, and they're also the natural things we evolved to eat, but they're right. Anti-inflammatory.
Well, that's interesting. We can talk about this for a second. So I will say that surgeons maybe have the worst diets of anybody I know. I remember sitting down with one of my fellows one day, and he sat down with 3 bags of popcorn and 3 Pepsis. Going, okay.
Oh, that's
so we'll go. But what I have learned, so what's fascinating about this whole inflammation process is I have severe arthritis in my right hip and right knee. I read a review article in the New England Journal of Medicine in December, and they were talking about intermittent fasting. And so the anti-inflammatory effects of intermittent fasting are profound. And I did start doing the 16 hours off every day. I've not had breakfast yet this morning. And I would say my pain dropped down 60% within 2 weeks. And I'm going to go back to eating my usual stuff, which isn't great. My pain drops right back up. So it turns out that anti-inflammatory diet, either intermittent fasting, whatever route you choose, or the vegetable-based, the plant-based diet, is actually a pretty big deal. And if you asked me that question 3 years ago, I just would have laughed at you. But you're absolutely correct, is that the particularly processed foods are inflammatory, as you can imagine. The fat goes right to your gut. It inflames the liver. So, yeah, no, that's one of the major factors. So, again, with the cytokine storm and COVID, if you want to improve your chance of survival, start with an anti-inflammatory diet, right? Your levels of cytokines are lower. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, what did we learn in medical school relevant to all this? The only thing that comes to my mind is do no harm, but we didn't carry that one forward after we grew up and became doctors.
Well, the problem is happening right now with the business of medicine. There's an article written in 1927 by Dr. Francis Peabody called The Care of the Patient, and he was a surgeon. And his lecture was based on the time that he was worried about technology interfering with the care of the patient. And so he gave an example of Mrs. Jones, who had abdominal pain. Back then they used the barium and stuff to run the gut, and they didn't find much. And they said, Mrs. Jones, we can't find anything wrong. Go home and have a good life. Well, she's going home to an abusive husband. Okay, that changes your body's chemistry. Yeah. And what happens under threat, you actually shut down the blood supply to your gut. You have an inflammatory response from your sympathetic nervous system. Your gut and bladder don't work anymore. And so what they call medically unexplained symptoms is simply nonsense, because your body's full of inflammation and elevated cortisol and all these different things going on. Things are not right. So the symptoms are perfectly explained by the sustained exposure to threat. So now you jump ahead now, medicine has become extraordinarily predatory. And I don't want to throw the doctors under the bus completely, because doctors want to talk to the patients. We have a burnout rate now of about 70%. Ironically, the thing that prevents burnout is actually talking to the patients. But almost every one of us now is on a quota. We have about 7 to 15 minutes to talk to a given patient. We maybe have a half an hour for a new patient. And we're on a production line. And so remember, we talked about the problem with chronic pain is sustained exposure to threat, whether it's mental or physical. The solution for chronic pain is safety. Because in a sense of safety, your body chemistry changes to dopamine, serotonin, the GABA drugs, growth hormone, and a great chemical bath and anti-inflammatory cytokines. So the safety is going to start with the doctor's office, because if you're not safe with your doctor, where can you be safe? So with the insurance companies taking away our capacity to talk to the patients is actually completely harming the patients. And if you can't help the patient feel safe, either socially or mentally or with your relationship, the rest of it doesn't matter. So that's what I was talking about in my operating on your pain or anxiety. I realized that, okay, these guys all get better as they calm down the nervous system. I realized that a lot of the surgery I had been doing, even in structural problems, was being done for anxiety, not for a structural problem. And then the tools required to calm down the nervous system are extremely simple, does not require medications. They're simply things we talked about that are anti-inflammatory, like mindfulness, meditation, relaxation, acupuncture, massage, physical therapy, all those things calm you down. The expressive writing calms you down. Forgiveness calms you down. The problem with those is that none of those are financially viable. I think I mentioned to you at the break that there's not one research paper in 60 years, not one, that says that spine surgery works for back pain. Not one. It's up to $20 billion a year. And what's even worse than that is that the research clearly shows that disc degeneration does not cause back pain. It does not. That's incredibly clear. That's the reason we're doing the surgeries. So it doesn't matter if it's a bone spur, degenerated disc, ruptured disc, whatever it is, none of those have been connected with back pain. None. So we have not one paper that shows that back surgery works, and we have actually documented the reason that we're doing the surgery is not the cause of pain. So do you know what the success rate is for a spine fusion for back pain? Just take a guess. If you're a back pain patient, what percent success would you like in order for a surgery to be done?
Well, I've known some back surgeons who have told me the same things you're telling me, that the surgery doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
I would not have a high hope for it, no.
Right. But, I thought it was 90%. I mean, I spent 8 years doing the surgeries. I mean, I was a zealot at one point. And so it took me 8 years to stop. And then the success rate of a back fusion for back pain is 22%. Doesn't work. So I did write the book called Do You Really Need Spine Surgery? And it breaks patients into four quadrants. So the first choice is your spine structural or non-structural. In other words, is there something you can see that should be fixed? And so with back pain, there's really something that you can see that should be fixed. If you have a bone spur pinching a nerve and the pain matches that nerve, the success rate is very high in spine surgery. So it's a structural or non-structural problem. Then the other part is, what is the state of your nervous system? So if you're calm and relaxed, your nervous system is receiving signals, processing them, no problem. If you're stressed and on high alert, your pain receptors change and you feel pain more, you don't cope with it as well. So the bottom line is, if you're calm with a structural problem, surgery works great. If you have a structural problem and you're stressed, then work on the stress, then do the surgery. Probably 70% of spine surgery should not be done. Okay, so most people that end up with spine surgery are stressed without something to operate on. So we're doing surgery on normal spines for people's age in stressed patients. We're creating disability really fast. We're actually actively hurting people.
Yeah. That's the same model as giving psychiatric drugs.
Right.
I mean, they don't work even 20% of the time. Placebo does, so you're at a wash, except that the drugs are toxic.
Right.
In psychiatry, the whole thing is we're just making people sicker, and sometimes
right.
that blunts your emotions, and you feel like you're better when you're not, and so on. But this whole model of doing harm is a very similar model of my wonderful audience is familiar with in terms of psychiatry. You know, it's
right.
just so common. We saw that at the beginning of the COVID-19 epidemic. I mean, I've had a Dr. Strauss, rather young doctor, ICU doctor on the show, and he was talking about that there really is almost no literature about doing all this intubation and pressurized breathing.
Right.
And the conclusion has come about now that that's probably killed more COVID patients than helped. And we
right.
have so many different things in medicine. And we've really, as a people, the American people, we have to stop listening to somebody because we think they're the expert. In fact, here's a principle that I think may be very valid, and see if it's your experience. And that is, the higher up people get in medicine, the less scientific they are. The more they are involved with making a reputation, building an institute, hobnobbing with politicians. And so you get to the top of the National Institute of Health or National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and you're dealing with people who aren't scientists at all. They don't care about science. They're interested in power and in money. The other place I saw that model when I was first a young man in learning was when I would do talk shows. My first big project was to stop the return of lobotomy. You probably don't know that about me. Here, you're a neurosurgeon.
I did see that. I learned to talk about that in some detail, by the way. That's incredible. So that's what we're doing in spine surgery.
Yeah,
I use the same metaphor. Is that when I talk about that metaphor, do you know John Loser by chance, or heard of him? He was actually at the tail end of frontal lobotomies. And I was commenting, well, doing spine surgery is like having frontal lobotomies. I mean, so, and John's point was, well, at least lobotomies did something.
Yeah.
Spine surgery
they made
does nothing.
You unable to feel.
Right. I mean, it accomplished something. But anyway, spine surgery does absolutely nothing except damage to the spine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the thing I learned was that I could have really really intelligent conversations with the local radio show hosts, of which there were many, many more in the 70s. And then the most intelligent conversation I would have would be on the way with the cabbie, or maybe the limo driver. And then the most conversations I'd have would be a local TV or a local radio show. And then when I got up and I was on 2020 and I was on it, or just every show you can imagine, you know, Oprah, with the exception of Oprah, who actually was smart. The higher up I got, the stupider people were.
Yeah, I think in medicine it goes a little bit deeper than that, in that we're taught silos of information of pathology, histology, neuros, anatomy, et cetera, but we don't integrate these things. So we have a physiology class, but the function of the nervous system is not taught in the context of physiology. So there's fight, flight, freeze, or faint. Your body chemistry is different with each one of those phases. Each one of those phases creates different symptoms, so we're not connecting the dots. And that's what I'm learning the last year, is how to connect these dots. And again, I love to have you be part of our think tank every week, is that it's remarkable about this group of people starting to put together the dots. And we're digging into the cytokines, the metabolism, the interaction of the nervous system, the neocortex with the midbrain, with the oxytocin. It's unbelievable. So we're not taught to think correctly. And so we start throwing random symptomatic solutions at a complex problem, and it doesn't work.
Right.
It can't work, right? So we're not taught to think. And I think that becomes more manifest, as you point out, as you go up the ladder, we become more and more entrenched in this pattern of thinking. So I think the problem is a pattern of thinking, as you know what I mean? I think it's that pattern that gets
pattern and what happens when you get power.
Right.
Yep. Then you can impose your pattern.
Right. And that I agree with. And of course, in medicine, I'll just talk about surgery for a second, is even more horrible, because your chief surgeon isn't that nice of a guy or a girl a lot of the time, right?
Yes.
So talking about imposing power, again, talking about the way we react as a culture to new information is not really creative. It's not free. It's not open. It's not questioning. And so, yeah, we just get really rigid thinking, really simplistic reaction to a problem. And we're just not taught to think anymore. So I do want to say something, though, is that in my book, it's called Back, the other book I wrote. So do you really need spine surgery? Just helps you make the decision whether you as a person should have surgery. In about 90 minutes, you can figure this out. So I'm not against surgery. I'm against surgery on normal spines. That makes no sense, right?
Well, yes, and you're also saying even abnormal spines, because you're repeating a theme that I've been learning about, which is, I mean, you just, people look at radiographs and they say this is the matter and we'll do surgery, but
right.
In fact, it's like reading tea leaves. It's not correlating.
Yeah, and there's also a paper out of Israel in 2014 that just blew me away. So we know that sleep is a big deal. Only 5% of physicians actually address sleep as an issue. And what's happening is that lack of sleep actually causes chronic pain, causes it. Mm-hmm. And again, it's about the inflammatory response. And so we're actually offering people 10 and 12 surgeries, and we're not checking in on their sleep. So the other book I wrote called Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, the idea is that there's nothing new in the book. These are all well-established, deeply established medical treatments that are effective. And so the data is there. So the idea is to implement what we know. So we have all these research papers done. The reason why I triggered that thought is that you mentioned how all this research is done, people publish their papers. And as you know, people sort of get fixated on their CVs more than making change. So we have a tremendous depth of knowledge to be mined to bring it into circulation. But let's just implement what we know. And again, going back to other conversations about safety versus threat, what we do know that safety is important. We do know that the doctor-patient relationship is really critical for healing. And it's not psychological even. It's just that your body's chemistry changes dramatically in the sense of safety. So you well know, as you establish a nice relationship with your patient, everybody relaxes. Okay, well, that changes your body's chemistry. So again, if you can't establish that foundation of care, the rest of it actually doesn't make any sense. So the book is Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. I just released a new process this week called The Doc Journey. It's actually at thedocjourney.com. And what it is that I've seen well over 1,500 patients go to pain-free. Whereas in medicine, chronic pain is considered untreatable, unsolvable. You have to live with it. Let's do the best you can do. We'll manage it for you. But I'm one of those people. 15 years solid of extreme chronic pain, I'm fine. And when my patients break out of this trap, it's unbelievable. The data shows that only 20% of physicians are comfortable managing chronic pain. Less than 1% enjoy it. I can tell you, take somebody without any hope, and they learn the tools. They now can take care of themselves. They can fend for themselves. So not only do they have hope, they have tools, they have weapons. They go to pain-free. And it's the most exciting process to watch these people break out of pain. So it's become by far the most rewarding part of my practice. So I would say conservatively, I've seen at least 1,500 patients break loose with this largely self-directed process. So the doc journey is the next evolution of the process. So it used to be with the book and the website that I had that people could navigate their way through it. And the doc journey is a much more streamlined pathway to come out of the process. It's an evolution based on awareness, hope, forgiveness, and play. But anyway, it's very self-directed, it's very effective, it's consistent, and really the only block to actually getting better is simply engaging in the process. And so we've been extremely excited about this. I quit my practice. I mean, I was at the peak of my career, great team, had a good time. And I just cannot watch people getting hurt like this and watching other people going pain-free with no risk.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful, wonderful work you're doing, and the parallels with, you know, what's just many of us coming together around these issues now. Not conventional medicine, not doctor-led medicine even really, but a cooperative effort and educating a patient and involving the patient and the information process.
Right.
It's just so key to everything. And the whole principle behind my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which is my latest book, the whole principle is you start with what the patient feels, what they're ready to do.
Right.
How fast do they want to go? Patient after patient is told by their psychiatrist, oh, you want to come off your medicine? All right. You're on an antipsychotic drug. Let's have it today, and then I'll see you in a week. We'll have it again. And that leads to psychosis. I mean, craziness,
right.
These severe withdrawal reactions. And it takes me a little while to convince people that we're actually going to work together. Well, how long will it take, Doc? Well, we'll work together and see how you're comfortable, what rate you want to go at, how it's working for you.
Right.
You're going to be the final arbiter. The only time I'll probably take a stand is if I think you're doing it too fast, because that's dangerous. But
right.
I'm certainly never going to push you to come off faster than you want. It's such a relief to people. So these are common principles of patient to client-oriented help.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. So this process evolved in Sun Valley, Idaho, where I was in solo practice, and I had no resources. I had to do everything myself. I had people on hundreds and hundreds of milligrams a day of opioids. And opioids were never a problem because guess what? I gave them control. I just got to know them. We worked on sleep, a little bit of homework. And then I'd always keep them the same dose of medications that they came in on. And we would work together and they would wean themselves down because they had control. So if you go to a doctor who starts fighting with you on day one about your dose of opioids, it increases your anxiety, which changes body chemistry and increases the pain. So the sense of control in relationship was phenomenal. Every clinician I know that successfully treats chronic pain has a knack for developing a very nice, warm relationship with their patients.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I mean, I think the bottom line is I think that mental pain is a much bigger problem than physical pain. Anxiety is the pain. And with medicine trying to treat this physiological response with random treatments is really sort of a human societal survival issue. Because when you lose control, you become angry. So anger is simply more stress chemicals. Anger is destructive. And right now, the root driving course of that is just uncontrollable anxiety. So medicine has got to get this right quickly, and we try to work on the symptoms and try to control things, but we have to get this right. We have to get this right quickly. I mean, I think you could solve the healthcare crisis with one intervention, and that is to triple or quadruple the fees for talking to your patients. Don't you think that would make a difference?
It would reverse the whole psychiatry thing. And
right.
All the people who go into psychiatry now who are these withdrawn control freaks who want to drug you and lock you up, they wouldn't go in no matter what you paid them and talk to people. They'd begin to slowly drop out, and then you'd get all the, you know, the nice men and women who want to share with people and talk to people and help them with share wisdom and maybe do a few things that are useful in the conversation. You'd reverse it because no amount of money, I think, could get the psychiatrists we have now to learn to talk.
Right.
That's not going to happen. But you'd reverse things and you'd start getting people in eventually who want to talk.
Right. What also happened in physiatry or physical medicine and rehab is that the physical medicine and rehab people would maximize function. But since they started doing injections, you can't get them to talk to patients anymore.
Oh, boy.
You just can't find physiatrists to talk to the patients.
It's so important.
It's very frustrating. I mean, I think the solution to chronic pain, by the way, is mostly a primary care, internal medicine, family practice, wellness issue. And I think psychiatry and psychology can be a huge adjunct to that. But it's really, you can't solve chronic pain because from a neuroplasticity standpoint, you actually reinforce it. But you can separate from that and move into health. So again, there's stress, there's sleep, there's physical conditioning, there's medication management, there's life outlook, there's diet, exercise. That's all primary care. And so to me, the solution in chronic pain is actually a primary care issue.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. But what I think primary care docs need is an office with a decent therapist in it and a nutritionist or... you can't do it all yourself. I don't think people are really good at handling all those aspects of human beings. I find that if I'm doing therapy, it's not really a good way for me to do nutrition. I've tried it a little bit. It's not what people are there for. I direct them to books and give them advice about it. And I think we need offices that have this integrated approach where you have people who are doing a variety of different things. And they all come down to the kinds of common final pathway you're describing, which you clarified for me actually today. So I'm grateful to you that to really every kind of stress produces very similar patterns.
Right.
I hadn't thought about it so much because I hadn't been thinking a lot about the physical stress issues as much as when I got involved with the COVID-19 and started looking at the cytokine storms and all these other things. Learn a lot now.
Right.
Steep learning curves I'm on. And it's all very exciting. It's very interesting. And
yeah, the doctors on this round table were all just blown away. And we're honestly.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah, and I'll send you the link. I feel like I've learned more in a year than I've learned in the last 30 years. We have a fourth year medical student who's on our round table who's just blown away. I mean, she's writing in medical school, and she, again, has learned about the separate parts of the body, but she's not really been taught how it all works together to create symptoms. So, but I mean, think about it. Every living creature takes sensory input. We respond to it in a way. The nociceptive system automatically puts us in a range of behaviors that keeps us safe. It's automatic. And so when you feel pain, by the way, it's actually you exceeded the boundaries of safety, so you get a signal that says danger. So this nociceptive system is a gift, and so when it goes out of balance, it's a big problem. So acute pain is necessary. There's nothing useful about being in chronic pain, nothing. In fact, they have two research papers show that the impact of chronic pain on a person's life is equivalent to having terminal cancer. And the one paper I just reviewed actually said it was worse quality of life, because at least with terminal cancer, you know what the problem is, and there's defined treatment plan. There's either a negative or a positive endpoint, but there's at least a defined endpoint. In chronic pain, you're suffering. Nobody can tell you what's going on. You lose hope, and who knows when it's going to end. There's no hope.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, and as you know, the way you create anxiety is uncertainty. So, yeah, the suffering in chronic pain is horrible. And that's why, again, it's been so exciting to take people with that much misery. And not only do they come out of the hole, they actually start thriving at a level that they've never experienced before. So it's been really, really incredible.
Well, we're drawing to a close. And for those of you who are listening on the radio and won't see his name up on the board, it's David Hanscom, H-A-N-S-C-O-M. And trained as a neurosurgeon, practiced as a neurosurgeon.
Actually, it's an orthopedic surgeon.
Orthopedic.
So
why am I saying neurosurgeon? I'm saying neurosurgeon because I've known neurosurgeons who did back surgery. Does that make sense?
So I'm a spine surgeon. So I'm more the overlap between neurosurgeon and orthopedic surgery is that I do spinal deformity work, scoliosis, kyphosis. We do surgeries. And neurosurgery works in the brain, which I don't work in the brain. But yeah, as far as the spine goes, the overlap is pretty much the same, except I do deformity. And so and some neurosurgeons do deformity, but most of the orthopedic surgeons.
I gotcha. So you meet at the spine.
Right. Yep.
Any closing thoughts, sir? It's been a very interesting, informative conversation. We have another minute or so. What you'd like to communicate?
Yeah, again, I would just strongly encourage you to understand, and I know it's hard to believe, but chronic pain is a solvable problem. The mental pain is a bigger problem than the physical pain. And the process is very self-directed by understanding the problem, addressing every aspect simultaneously, and then you take charge of your care. So the website is thedocjourney.com, thedocjourney.com, and it would introduce you a straight line pathway through the process. If you're considering spine surgery, essentially every person who's read my book on do you really need spine surgery has canceled the surgery.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, and I'm not against surgery. I mean, I'm a surgeon, but guess what? 70% of spine surgery should not be done. So my final parting words are just be careful out there.
Be careful.
Yeah.
Be careful. Be hopeful.
Yeah.
Careful.
Be careful, be hopeful. Yep, like it.
Thank you much. I look forward to seeing you again on in your group and talking to you about some other things.
So I'll send you the link, and I appreciate this very much. This is fantastic.
Wonderful interview.
Thanks.
Bye-bye, my wonderful audience. Thank you for taking this stuff serious.